Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Joining us on the show today for a brief conversation is Dr. Ivor van Heerden, a familiar voice. He's been on this program a couple of times before, most recently earlier this year. Are you still deputy director of the LSU Hurricane Center at this point in time?
No. That LSU terminated my position.
But you're still at the university?
Yes. They have to pay me through the middle of May next year, so I'm a de facto member of LSU right now.
And we're talking to you because this week the U.S. federal judge Stanwood Duvall issued a ruling. Listeners may have heard about it, finding a blistering opinion, 167 pages, I think, that found the Corps of Engineers culpable for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers culpable for the flooding of at least half a dozen citizens in the area near the notorious Mississippi River Gulf Outlet navigation canal. And you, Dr. van Heerden, were one of the witnesses for the plaintiffs. First of all, how do you feel about the judge's ruling, as if I didn't know?
Well, I would just point out, I ended up not being a witness because LSU barred me from being a witness in federal court. So I ended up being the lead consultant to the group, and I brought the Dutch teams on board to do some of the modeling. I'm obviously very excited. This is total vindication for those of us who've been pressing that this was a man-made disaster. Katrina in New Orleans was a man-made disaster rather than a natural event, and the only thing that Katrina was the trigger.
And what, since you were a consultant, you probably have some good contact with the attorneys on your side, at least. What do they feel, and what do you feel is the prospect for this decision to going forward? Do they think the federal government is going to appeal? What do they think their chances are on appeal? What do you think is going to happen now?
Well, even though this decision, this ruling related to six plaintiffs, there is a class action suit that includes many hundreds of thousands. And one of the plaintiffs wasn't compensated because the judge felt even though their home may have flooded as a result of the Corps of Engineers, there was immunity in that person's location. I think what's very important is this is just sending the signal to Congress, to the Obama administration, that the Corps of Engineers has done a very shoddy job for the last 50 years and is still doing such. I believe that the plaintiff's attorneys who are going to Washington next week to meet with some Obama folk will press very hard that we need to see a total change in the way coastal restoration and the levees and navigation are tackled in Louisiana. And I believe they're going to be successful. I have heard people like our Senator Mary Landrieu saying the Corps of Engineers is antiquated and they need to get out of the business. So this could herald three important things. One is compensation for those who lost so much, these families who lost everything overnight through no fault of their own. Two, significant federal dollars to restore the coastal wetlands, where most of the wetland loss is due to federal actions. And then thirdly, to fully federally fund the levees and the other storm surge protection measures that are needed.
That would be obviously, as Vin Scully, the Dodger broadcaster, says so often, consummation devoutly to be wished. But let me ask you finally, since you were working with Dutch experts in the preparation of the evidence that so overwhelmed and convinced and angered the judge in this case, what do you think the odds are that Dutch expertise is going to be invited in and play a part in the protection of this area going forward?
Well, I think this opens the door. Many of the Dutch engineers who are very well into the Dutch system and work for obviously for the Dutch government have complained to me on a number of trips that they feel that they've been locked out of the system. So I think by opening the door for others, by perhaps revamping the core or generating a new agency, would remove the domination of a few select engineering companies in coastal Louisiana that do all the work for the Corps of Engineers. Certainly, the national environmental groups are looking at a design competition where they would offer $1 million reward for a future design of the whole of the lower Mississippi River. And this is how the Dutch do it. This is how the British do it, and it's certainly something that hopefully we will start doing and bringing in expertise from countries where they have been successful in dealing with storm surges.
Gee, competition, that's supposed to result in a better result, isn't it?
Yes, I think, when you open it up, you allow the best brains in the world to compete, and the Dutch do this certainly on their award-winning butterfly gates, the Maasland gates. They had a design competition, and they had an independent panel review the designs, and they came up with this really fantastic and very efficient and effective structure, the butterfly gates. So, we need new ideas. Obviously, we've been going along for 50 years, depending on the core. There's been no outside review of what they've done, and we've ended up in this terrible situation where, you have a judge basically saying they're responsible for the deaths of everybody and all the destruction in New Orleans.
Dr. Van Heerden, thank you for spending a little bit of your Sunday, and congratulations on your and your team's initial success at least the district federal court level.
Well, thanks, Harry. We'll just keep on trucking.
Thank you.
Hello, welcome to the show. I'm not afraid to die. way down in Bohemia. Way down in Bohemia.
From along the shores of the James River in Richmond, Virginia, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And ladies and gentlemen, first from the news from the Digital Wonderland, from Paul, a listener, who says, Dear Harry. Well, he doesn't say Dear Harry. I'm just interpolating that because I'd like him to be saying that. Dear Harry, digital TV provides an information screen that ostensibly lists program information, but certain captions seem to get stuck for days, persisting despite multiple rescanning. Thus, for days, I have been encountering this disturbing caption, quote, "A badly injured horse dies on a nearby beach," unquote. I don't know why. At the moment, they're broadcasting a soccer game. That's the wonder. That's why it's a wonderland. It makes you wonder. TV that makes you wonder. Don't you think that's worth it? And ladies and gentlemen, from the fun fact department, you know the Army this week announced a full investigation of the shooting incident at Fort Hood. And maybe they'll come up with an explanation of this along the way. Do you know why Fort Hood, after whom Fort Hood is named? Just a, you know, a little quiz question for you. I didn't. A listener pointed me toward this information, and here it is from, sometimes they're not always right, but this checks out, I think. Fort Hood is named for John Bell Hood. Thank you. Good night. Oh, no, you want to know more. All right. John Bell Hood was, ladies and gentlemen, and this is a United States Army base we're talking about, he was a Confederate general during the Civil War. Well, he must have been a great general, because he was from the other side to be named the namesake of a U.S. Army base, don't you think? Quoting, "Hood had a reputation for bravery and aggressiveness that sometimes bordered on recklessness. Arguably one of the best brigade and division commanders in the Confederate Army, Hood became surprisingly ineffective as he was promoted to lead larger independent commands late in the war, and his career was marred by his decisive defeats leading an army in the Atlanta campaign and the Franklin-Nashville campaign," now a bank, of course. So that's Mr. Hood from Fort Hood, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know what the lesson is there. Lose to the Americans, I guess, and you'll get a base named after you. And now,
he's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general.
Oh, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, news from Inspectors General. I'll point out right at the top here, it's a copyrighted feature of the broadcast. You probably know about this report. I think it made the news where you are. When insurance giant AIG teetered last fall on the brink of collapse, threatening to take a lot of Wall Street with it, the New York branch of the Federal Reserve, led by Timothy Geithner. Timothy Geithner, sorry to go to the falsetto mode there, chose to make whole the likes of Goldman Sachs and foreign banks at the expense of good old U.S. taxpayers. This finding was part of an investigation of the AIG bailout by the Inspector General of the TARP program, who said Geithner's office refused to use its considerable leverage to negotiate less expensive buyouts of the contracts that banks held with AIG. Instead, they got 100 cents on the dollar. Inspector General Neil Barofsky found even when one party, UBS Bank of Switzerland, offered to take a modest reduction in resolving the mess, Geithner decided, oh no, to reimburse everyone 100 cents on the dollar for the toxic assets that AIG was insuring. Tens of billions of dollars of government money was funneled inexorably and directly to AIG's counterparties. In addition to Goldman and UBS, other banks that received full coverage from Geithner's bailout plan were Merrill Lynch, Deutsche Bank, Wachovia, why you can see it from here, Barclays, and Bank of America. Good work, Tim.
And U.S. taxpayer money that was supposed to be used for emergency purposes in Iraq was spent to buy a special advertising issue for an Anbar businessman in a British trade magazine. It was an emergency. It was the deadline was approaching. FDI magazine, a bimonthly print publication and website owned by the Financial Times, nearly simultaneously showered Anbar Governor Qasim Abid al-Muhammad Hamadi al-Fadawi, not enough names, babe, with positive coverage praising the dangerous Anbar province as, quote, a hot place to invest in, and giving the businessman an award as Global Personality of the Year for this year, this very year we're living in. That award was announced 3 days before the special report on Anbar, entitled Bridge to the Future, was published on its website. The award was immediately praised by the U.S. military in Iraq without mention of the U.S. funds spent on the advertising supplement, and the website makes no mention of it having been paid for by the American government. Last month, again, FDI magazine Courtney Finger handed the governor another award, naming Anbar Province one of FDI magazine's standout regions of the year. I'll stand outside it. Reached by a publication called The Cable, Finger confirmed the U.S. government had spent in the neighborhood of $50,000 on the special supplement, but denied her magazine's content had been bought and paid for, which would be the first thing in Iraq that wasn't. News of the Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Speaking of which, we're faced today with, you know, a severe case of, on the one hand, this, and on the other hand, that. The Anbar province, which was home of major problems when Al-Qaeda in Iraq was running amok, or Al-Qaeda in amok was running Iraq in 2006, 2007. Now we learn from the Washington Post that Al-Qaeda in Iraq is regaining strength. They've retooled. Now it's no longer composed of foreign fighters. Now it's mainly Iraqis. Thank you for that. While Dexter Filkins in the New York Times says, uh-oh, the United States is now supporting, financing, helping new militias in Afghanistan to fight against the Taliban, because it worked out so well the last time we financed militias. But he says that it's going to be modeled on the surge. The surge is when we paid off the Sunnis to leave Al-Qaeda in Iraq until our money ran out and the Iraqi government didn't pick up the tab. Looking good. Looking really good. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there is a name you are going to hear not that often on today's program. You've heard enough of it. Everybody and their brother has been sucked into the Made You Look game that's been going on this week. So I'm going to soft pedal it. You're only going to hear this name in this once in this context of setting up what you're about to hear, which is Larry King interviewing Joe the Plumber on what he thought of Sarah Palin's book.
Before we get back with the panel, in Las Vegas is Joe Wurzelbacher. You know him as Joe the Plumber. Here's what Palin had to say about you in her book. Joe the Plumber reminded me personally of those country kitchen guys I'd sat with on Friday mornings in Wasilla when I was mayor. I liked him. Joe, did you like her?
Yeah, I liked her a lot. She was real genuine. She didn't sit there and try to wow me with her being Sarah Palin. She just sat there and talked to me like a regular person, and I enjoyed that. I've met a lot of politicians that sit there and think I should be on my knees worshiping them. So she was a fresh, difference there.
You think she's going to run for president?
Yeah, I liked her answer that she gave Oprah, which, I mean, I thought Oprah did a pretty good job, but I don't know. But she said that you don't necessarily have to be in a position of leadership, you know, in office to exact change in America. And I think that's really her calling. I mean, she can get out there and really motivate the grassroots of this country to get back involved and take our country back. And so I hope that she does that, to be honest with you, because, I mean, she can really get out there and talk and get people excited and get them back involved in our government. Not necessarily politics, Larry, but back involved in our government. So I'm looking forward to see what she does.
What about the off-air statement, Joe? Is she frankly, really qualified to be president?
Well, that's a question that everyone's asking. You know, look how many experts are in Washington, and look at where we're at economically in our country right now. I mean, it seems like we're at a crossroads. So I don't know if I really want an expert running our country. I think we need to get back to the basic principle of our countries. And if that's going to be someone who has five children and can run the state of Alaska, you know, she's got my vote. I really like her, her love our country. So I don't see anything wrong with her as far as that stuff goes. She, like I said, she's genuine. She really wants to serve the country. She wants to serve her fellow man to where our current politicians want to serve themselves. And you see that in the Republicans and you see that in the Democrats. So I really like her.
Thanks, Joe. Good seeing you again.
Hey, thanks, Larry. Have a great night.
Joe the plumber.
Who's not a plumber. But then again, Larry, I guess Dewey Gordon, formerly of the boy band Boys R Us, hit the nail right on the head.
He's the average Joe, but with common sense. Call him on the phone or lean over his fence. Can you write him off as a business expense? Just ask Joe the plumber. Joe. He's the guy in the very last row. Just don't let him near your sink. Joe the plumber looms about as large as a hummer. Wish I'd known him back last summer. Joe the plumber. Just ask Joe the plumber. Just ask Joe the plumber.
Joe the plumber. Zooms about as large as a hummer. Wish I'd known him back last summer. Joe the plumber. Just ask Joe the plumber. Just ask Joe the plumber. 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 Joe the plumber.
This is Le Show from Richmond, Virginia. Think of it. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Starting off with Prime Minister Kevin Rudd of Australia, who has gathered a bunch of the victims in question at the House of Parliament in Canberra, Australia, this week.
To say to you, the forgotten Australians, and those who were sent to our shores as children without their consent, that we are sorry. Sorry that as children you were taken from your families and placed in institutions where so often you were abused. Sorry for the physical suffering, the emotional starvation, and the cold absence of love, of tenderness, of care. Sorry for the tragedy, the absolute tragedy, of childhoods lost.
Aside from that, did you have a good time in Australia, kids? Of course, they're not kids anymore. Ladies and gentlemen, Lloyd Blankfein, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Goldman Sachs, apologized this week for his firm's role in some of the activities leading to the financial crisis and announced they were giving the government billions. No, he didn't do that. We participated in things that were clearly wrong and have reason to regret, Blankfein said at a conference in New York, hosted by Directorship Magazine. Yeah, I know. My subscription lapsed, too. But he went on. He said, no, he didn't. He said the firm is very concerned about the criticism because our reputation is very important to us. Okay. I know how important it is. Representative John Shadegg, Republican of Arizona, has apologized for suggesting that if 9/11 trials are held in New York City, Mayor Michael Bloomberg's daughter could be kidnapped. I saw the mayor of New York said today, we're tough, we can do it. Well, mayor, how are you going to feel when it's your daughter that's kidnapped at school by a terrorist? Shadegg said. The following afternoon, he told AP he's sorry, but added that his point was still a good one. I apologize for the insensitivity of my remarks with respect to the mayor or his family. However, I think it is important to note that this decision involves potential risk to innocent people. A contrite Rupert Murdoch. When have you heard me say that before? When have you heard anybody say that before? Placed a personal call to New York Governor David Paterson this week to apologize for slamming the legally blind governor during a Wall Street Journal CEO council. A source close to the governor confirmed. Paterson accepted the call, accepted Murdoch's apology for saying political discourse in New York has become so polarized because, the quote, the governor is blind and can't read Braille and doesn't know what's going on, unquote. Roop. Roop. What you doing, Roop? Paterson was willing to chalk the comments up to a random misstatement. So much that Rupert does is random, don't you think? Speaking of which, Fox News delivered an on-the-air apology to viewers this week after a second incident within a month when the network illustrated a story by using video footage taken from a different event. Jane Skinner, a Fox anchor, explained to viewers that Fox had improperly used videos from a 2008 Sarah Palin campaign event to illustrate coverage of supposedly crowds lining up this week for her book appearance. That'll be the last time you hear that name today. And I don't mean Jane Skinner. Earlier this month, Fox used video footage from a much larger rally to underscore a point being made by Sean Hannity about the number of people attending a Washington protest. The incident seemed more obviously inadvertent this week, according to New York Times, because the anchor Greg Jarrett, in describing the crowd, alluded to lines of people outside a bookstore while the pictures on the screen clearly showed Palin at a campaign event. Oops, there's that name again. Skinner in the apology said, quote, we didn't show the video we were actually referencing and said the footage, which came in what is known as a tease for an upcoming story, should have contained the information that it was file footage. We didn't mean to mislead anyone, Skinner said. Meanwhile, one of Fox's competitors, MSNBC, also apologized this week for manipulating images. Dylan Radigan's show used a photoshopped image of that same Alaska governor. I forget her name now. Shooting a gun while wearing a bikini. On his next program, Radigan called the use of the doctored photo unacceptable and said, I want to apologize to Governor and all of our viewers. So, and that'll be the last time that I mentioned Dylan Radigan. The NFL flags and fines players for excessive celebration on the field. Commissioner Roger Goodell has now sent a very clear message. The league's owners aren't above those same rules. The NFL fined Titans owner Bud Adams $250,000 this week for making obscene hand gestures at Buffalo fans while celebrating Tennessee's 41-17 win over the Bulls. Adams was seen making the gesture both from his luxury suite, classy move, and again on the field at the end of the game last week. The Titans declined to comment after the fine was issued, but Adams issued an apology. He also said he expected league discipline for his actions. "I need to specifically apologize to the Bills, their fans, our fans, and the NFL," he said. But wait, there's more. The superintendent for Rockingham County Schools in North Carolina has apologized for the suspension of two students last week who brought fast food for lunch, a violation of the school's lunch policy. Superintendent Rodney Shotwell apologized on behalf of the school system. "This is the way it was before I was superintendent, but they had an issue more so with the employees bringing outside food and the kids seeing it, and it's kind of competition with the cafeteria," Shotwell said, a school superintendent using the world's longest run-on sentence. But yeah, it is kind of competing with the cafeteria, and we wouldn't want that. An Illinois competition, you know. An Illinois congressman who opposes the idea of moving terrorism suspects to a prison in his district issued a qualified apology this week after a comment that critics viewed as insulting to Islam. In an interview with a television statement, Republican Representative Donald Manzullo said of terrorism suspects, "These are really, really mean people whose job it is to kill people driven by some savage religion," unquote. An aide said Manzullo, who opposes the possibility of housing Gitmo detainees in the Thompson Correctional Center in northwestern Illinois, received about 20 complaints about the remark. In a statement, Mazzullo said he was not referring generally to Islam, but to terrorists who practice a violent, anti-modern version of Islam. He said Islam is a religion of peace. He said, "Nevertheless, I apologize for any misunderstandings of my comments, and I will endeavor in the future to clarify my remarks to make it absolutely clear that America is not opposed to Islam." Uh-oh, I have to say this name again. Sarah Palin has apologized to hundreds of people who waited for hours in a light rain in central Indiana for a book signing event but didn't end up getting her signature. Oh, let the machine do it. The former Alaska governor said on her Facebook site that she was told about what happened in Noblesville, Indiana, on Thursday night and was working on a solution for those who were left behind. See, she sneaks in a plug for another book. There was an apology in that Facebook thing as well. The road manager for the Black Eyed Peas, Liborio Polo Molina. That's a good name. Liborio Polo Molina. Polo being his nickname. Road manager. I don't think it's because he plays polo. I don't know any road managers in rock and roll who play polo, but maybe there is one. Anyway, Polo offered up a half-hearted apology for punching Perez Hilton. Do you know who any of these people are? Outside a Toronto nightclub in June. He quickly added that the punch could have been avoided if the celebrity blogger, that's Perez Hilton, hadn't instigated the situation by calling the lead singer of the band that Molina works for a unpleasant name for gay people starting with an F. "I apologize for what I did on June 22, even though you engaged in highly offensive comments, including a homophobic slur to my clients. I acknowledge that these kinds of issues should not be resolved through a physical response," Molina said. In exchange for that apology, Hilton agreed to withdraw assault charges. The judge imposed several other minor conditions on Molina. He's barred from directly or indirectly communicating with Perez Hilton. Must stay clear of the nightclub where the imbroglio occurred and cannot carry any weapons while he's in Canada. I thought nobody could carry any weapons in Canada. He also kicked in $500 to a woman's shelter. He still has a civil suit, does Perez Hilton, against Molina, seeking more than $25,000 in damages for a black eye, ironically, of course, because Molina works for the Black Eyed Peas. Oprah Winfrey gave Robin Givens a lengthy apology on her last Friday's show over the manner in which she didn't deal with a comment made last month by the actress's ex-husband, Mike Tyson. On a previous episode of Oprah's show, Tyson was asked about their 1998 TV interview in which Givens revealed he had physically abused her. "At that particular moment, I truly wanted to sock her, but I didn't," said Tyson to Oprah as her audience laughed. Givens, who's a spokesperson for the National Domestic Violence Hotline, told Winfrey her non-reaction was hard to stomach. "I was really hurt, really, really hurt," she said. Winfrey tried to explain what the mood was like that day in the studio. She apologized to Givens
for what happened. I hope you accept my apology. She said, I have a lot of empathy and compassion for Mike Tyson and still do, but that never makes hitting women okay. It's never okay, said Oprah. So much for Foxy Boxing. Several Dateline Miami, several Jackson Memorial Hospital nurses personally apologized to Janice Longben, a Washington State lesbian who said a social worker at the hospital wouldn't allow her to be with her dying partner in 2007. Quote, we're certainly sorry for the pain and suffering she felt, said Martha Baker, a registered nurse. I apologize, said registered nurse Norberto Molina, probably no relation. I can't imagine what you went through. Toledo public school officials are apologizing after an employee threw away a memorial for a high school graduate who died in a car crash. The family of 20-year-old Ashley Snyder took pictures when they found the makeshift memorial torn down and in a nearby dumpster. We're working together with the family to put a replacement memorial in the same spot. The employee thought it had already been there for a few weeks and was okay to remove. And the prime minister and the leader of the opposition in Great Britain, heading towards a big election coming soon, have apologized after the Dean of Westminster Abbey rebuked them for the behavior at a service, a memorial service to mark the passing of the First World War generation. Cameron arrived ahead of the service. He's the conservative with his own photographer and had his picture taken, inspecting tributes to the fallen. Brown then hurriedly made arrangements to be photographed in the same place with his wife. Officials acting on behalf of the Dean of the Abbey were angered that neither of them had sought permission for the photo shoots and made formal complaints. They both immediately apologized in writing and have pledged to avoid a repeat of the incident if the Abbey avoids the repeat of World War I. Japanese Trade Minister Masayuki Naoshima apologized for leaking gross domestic product data before the official release time, said he'd been misinformed about the release time. And finally, at the bottom, well, it's about the Clippers. Los Angeles Clippers announcers Ralph Lawler and Michael Smith were suspended for one day after they joked on the air about the center of the Memphis Grizzlies, who were playing against the Clippers, Haddadi, an Iranian. First, they pronounced the name of the country Iran, and then they joked, did Michael Smith to Ralph Lawler, that Haddadi might, in fact, be Borat's brother. Quote, we regret the remarks made by Clipper announcers during Wednesday's telecast, Fox Sports said in a statement. Ooh, more sorrow from Fox. While we believe that Michael and Ralph did not intend their exchange to be offensive, the comments were inappropriate. We extend, continued Fox, our apologies to Hamed Haddadi and to anyone who was offended. We have addressed the situation with Michael and Ralph and have taken appropriate action. Oh, and British low-cost airliner EasyJet has apologized after fashion photographs shot at the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin were published in its in-flight magazine. Don't mess with the Holocaust, babe. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. It is so. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
There you go again. The truth begins to bend. And like a fool, I hang on every word. Promise me the moon, and then you change your tune. You must be a mockingbird. The mockingbird's voice sounds so sweet, but he'll say anything. Oh, he'll sit outside your window and sing to you all day. Oh, I want you, oh, my darling, come with me. Hold him, he flies away. Last night I sat at home, waiting by the phone. Left the porch light burning all night long. But I never heard a sound. I guess somewhere way across town, someone else was listening to your song. Mockingbird's voice sounds so sweet, but he'll say anything. When you say forever, what you really mean is never.
This is LeShow. Ladies and gentlemen, you're aware that President Obama this week paid a visit to Asia, most particularly China. While he was there, he held meetings with the president of China, Hu Jintao, and the premier, Wen Jiabao. And he also, I believe, gave at least one interview, despite the war that's been going on over the last few months, the war of words, between the Obama administration and the Fox News channel. I think there's another interview on that subject with that channel yet to air.
First up on The Factor tonight, and it's an honor, whatever you think of him. It's been a long time coming, and here he is on The Factor. It's an honor for him, too, I'm sure. The President of the United States. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Bill. I know it hasn't been easy to get our two schedules together, and other things have intervened.
Yeah.
But I'm glad to be with you. We've had a great trip to China, and I'm proud to talk about it and to talk about some of the accomplishments that we achieved while we were there.
Okay, Mr. President, you talk about accomplishments. When you sat down with the president of China, I mean, we owe them more money than this country is ever going to make in our lifetimes.
Well,
and you sat you sat down with who?
Yes, I did.
No, I'm asking. When you had your talk, who was it that you talked to?
Well, there were a number of conversations over the course
of
a couple of days. Yeah. And who was definitely on the list?
Who was?
That's right.
You know, we don't have to play this game.
No.
You're talking with the president of China.
Mm-hmm.
That's who?
Yes, it is.
All right. There were other people that you had meetings with while you were on this trip.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So you want to share any of those names with us?
Yeah. When?
Well, I mean, we were taping now.
No, I understand.
So if you'd like to share any of those names.
I talked to when.
And I thought you talked to who.
I talked to who and then when.
Okay. Let me just try to nail this down, Mr. President, because I know you don't have a lot of time for this.
No.
You talked to the president of China.
That's right.
That's who.
That's right. And Bill, if I can advance the story a little bit.
Please, please.
The next day came when?
Probably when you woke up.
Well.
All right, so you're sitting down and you're talking to, let's say you're talking to who?
That's right.
What'd you tell him?
Well, I told him and when, basically, that the United States has certain expectations about human rights.
Good.
That we would tie any improvement in trade practice to human rights improvements that were certified to us.
That's great.
By the Chinese government.
Mm-hmm.
And who was noncommittal?
Who was?
Right. But we did get something more of a commitment, I think, later from when.
When was this?
That's right. But our people are pretty certain that he couldn't have done that if who hadn't signed off on it.
All right. Well, where were these talks held?
Oh, all the talks were at Hu's palace.
Of course they were. Mm-hmm. What did I think? President Obama.
Yeah.
I know you have a little more time, but we've got to get a part three of the Sarah Palin interview.
Uh-huh.
Thank you again.
Thank you, Bill.
Coming up on The Factor, Bernie Goldberg wonders why Dan Rather isn't dead yet.
And now, news from outside the bubble. In the, can you imagine the nerve department from the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch, but that's not the nerve part. The chief of the OPEC oil cartel says that oil-producing countries should be compensated for lost revenues if the UN climate talks in Copenhagen, almost did that, next month, compensated if the climate talks reach a deal that results in the reduction in the use of oil. Pay us more for using less oil. In an interview with the Times, Abdullah Salem al-Badri of Libya says richer oil-consuming nations such as Britain and the U.S. should acknowledge that historically they've created the most carbon dioxide emissions and should not be allowed to block poorer countries from raising living standards. We are not emitting, he says. Historically, it's the developed countries. Responsibility is on their shoulders. But they want more money if we use less oil. The Afghan government could fall within weeks if NATO pulled out troops now, says the British Foreign Secretary, as he urged British opponents of the war to give the fight to rebuild the country more time. This is the same time as John McCain is saying, if we send more troops, he sure will win within 18 months. In an interview with the British newspaper The Guardian at the end of a visit to Kabul, the Foreign Secretary said, if international forces leave, you can choose a time, 5 minutes, 24 hours, or 7 days, but the insurgent forces will overrun those forces that are prepared to put up resistance, and we would be back to square one, as opposed to the square we're at now. Also from The Guardian, 3 months after the release of Abdul Basit al-Megrahi, the only man convicted of the Lockerbie bombing, the families of American victims of the Lockerbie bombing have reignited a row over the medical advice that allowed him to be freed early. You may remember he was freed early because doctors said he had 3 months to live. It's 3 months. He's alive. Relatives of the victims have been monitoring the release, counting down the days. This week, the three-month period passed. Today, this week, actually, a Democratic senator from New York, Charles Schumer, called for the immediate return of the Libyan former intelligence agent to prison in Scotland. He's been treated at Tripoli's medical center, but has not been seen in public since the day in September when he was photographed in a wheelchair, coughing badly, looking frail, and surrounded by visiting African members of parliament. So maybe we need Libyan health care. Maybe that's the answer. Because he's doing okay in a Libyan hospital. From the Telegraph, the British newspaper, the Telegraph, and written by Andrew Gilligan, a journalist who was fired from the BBC for saying on the radio that apparently the dossier that Tony Blair had used to convince the British public to go into the Iraq War had been sexed up. Anyway, here's Andrew Gilligan's report. On the eve of a new inquiry into Britain's involvement in the Iraq War, the Sunday Telegraph has obtained hundreds of pages of secret British government reports on lessons learned, which shed new light on significant shortcomings at all levels. They include full transcripts of extraordinarily frank classified interviews in which British Army commanders vent their frustration and anger with the government. The reports disclose that Tony Blair misled MPs and the public throughout 2002 when he claimed that Britain's objective was disarmament, not regime change, and that there had been no planning for military action. In fact, British military planning for a full invasion and regime change began in February of that very year. The need to conceal that from Parliament and all but very small numbers of officials constrained the planning process. The result was a rushed operation lacking in coherence and resources, which caused significant risk to troops and critical failure in the post-war period. This from secret government reports that have been leaked to the Telegraph. Operations were so under-resourced that some troops went into action with only 5 bullets each. Others had to deploy to war on civilian airliners, taking their equipment as hand baggage. Some troops had weapons confiscated by airport security. Commanders reported that the Army's main radio system tended to drop out at around noon each day because of the heat. One described the supply chain as absolutely appalling, saying, "I know for a fact there was one container full of skis in the desert." The Foreign Office unit to plan for post-war Iraq was set up only in late February 2003, 3 weeks before the war began. The plans contained no detail for once Baghdad had fallen, causing a notable loss of momentum which was exploited. Field commanders raged at the government's appalling and horrifying lack of support for reconstruction, with one top officer saying the government missed a golden opportunity to win Iraqi support. Another commander said it was not unlike 1750s colonialism, where the military had to do everything ourselves. News from outside. Oh, and the Canadian government was fending off calls for a public inquiry on torture this week after allegations from one of its senior diplomats that Canada was complicit in the torture of Afghan detainees. This from The Guardian. Richard Colvin, second-in-command at Canada's Kabul embassy in 2006 and 7, said Afghans swept up its security sweeps by Canadian troops during that time were routinely handed over to the Afghan intelligence services. According to our information, he told Canada's parliament, they have a parliament? The likelihood is that all the Afghans we handed over were tortured. For interrogators in Kandahar, it was standard operating procedure. In other words, we, the Canadians, detained and handed over for severe torture a lot of innocent people. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And I don't know if you know this, Playboy Enterprises is in talks to be sold for about $325 million. Hugh Hefner, 83-year-old, is giving up control over the adult entertainment empire he founded. What could possibly come next?
Hi, I'm Hugh Hefner. Welcome to Playboy's Pawn Shop. Each week, we'll rummage through what's left of my fabulous lifestyle to come up with that must-have addition to your world. Today, it's my famous round bed. Oh, many of the days I've spent on this handcrafted piece of exquisitely erotic furniture, lounging in my black silk pajamas with my two or three girlfriends, while thinking up bits and pieces of my famous philosophy. The bed can be yours. The pajamas, the girlfriends, and the philosophy, of course, sold separately. Come join the sophisticated excitement and join the bidding on your touch-tone phone or your computer. It's Playboy's Pawn Shop, this week on the Playboy Channel. And next week on the Pawn Shop, the Playboy Channel is up for sale. See you then.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over the same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave. Try it in your car, shortwave. It does happen. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet on your computer to two different locations whenever you want it, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphone via stitcher.com. Available as a free download for members at audible.com/LeShow. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. Just stick it in your pod. And be just like not being at square one. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the songs heard hereon. It's part of the potpourri of fabulousness at harryshearer.com. A tip of the Le Show Chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead, and thanks today to Steve Clark here at WCVE in Richmond, Virginia, for helping to make today's show possible. The show is on Twitter at LeTwits, and the new video starring Timothy Geithner singing Glimmers of Hope will be available this week, I believe Tuesday, at mydamnchannel.com. Very happy Thanksgiving from everybody at me. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.